Funny, we've had a lot of students like Hebrew more than Greek, and others Greek more than Hebrew.
Well, things like the hard one. I mean, you gotta go high,
hey,
and, right. You know, but it's a lot easier than.
Well, it's better than 16 forms.
And,
yeah. You got a point there. Did I give you next a week from next Tuesday is the day for the test?
November
1st, yeah. I had it written down someplace, but somehow I erased it. Okay.
You're going to give us vocabulary before that?
Probably after. We'll add some more. Today, remember, pick up where we left off here. Don't forget, on this test coming up a week from Tuesday, there will be a question about how you've been doing on your reading the last 2 weeks. So you'll be asked to score yourself from 0 to 10 points over your reading for the last 2 weeks. So be sure that you keep up on that 5 minutes a day. And today, I think last time we read, we got close to the end. I want to get up to verse 28. So let's just take a look at John 1, starting verse 19 through verse 28, and we'll read that together. Let's see, I guess I'll read it. I don't remember how far we've read. I think we got up around 23 or so, didn't we, once? Through 18. Is that all the farther we've read? Okay. Okay, well, I'll go from 19 to 28 here first, so you can hear it, and then we'll do it all together. So starting in verse 19, I'll just do it first so you can hear it. Just try to read along with your read along as I'm reading, and maybe even under your breath, try to read along and just pick it up first time, and then we'll go through it all together. Kai haute estin he marturia tu iwanu hota apestelon, excuse me, pros auton hoi iudaioi ex Jerusalemon hieres kai levitas hina erotesosin auton Sutis A. Kai homologesen kai uk ernesato kai homologesen hoti ego uk e miho Christos. Kai erotesan auton ti un su elias a kai lege uk e mi. O prophetes a su kai apokryphe u. Epan un auto tis a. Hina apokrisen domen tois pemsasen hemas. Ti leges perise autu, efe, ego phone boontos en te eremo. Should recognize that te eremo. What case form is that?
Dative.
Right, okay. And we're looking at a...
Feminine
second declension. Good, okay. Just want to see if you're still on your toes there. El thunate ten hodon kuriu. Kathos apen Esaias. Now this is interesting because you see those little two little dots on either side of the accent on the iota there? That's to indicate that this is not a diphthong. Alpha iota is a common diphthong, but this is to indicate that this is not a diphthong. So it's Esaias. You're going to go ahead and pronounce not Esaias, but Esaias. Ho prophetes. And lots of times you get transliterations from Hebrew and so forth. You have to try to break the pattern somewhat. Kai apestomenoi eisan ek ton pharisaion, kai erotesan auton, kai epan auto, ti un baptizes esu uk eho Christos, ude elias, ude ho prophetes. apocryphe autois ho Ioannes legon ego baptizo en hudati mesos humon hesteken hon humes uk oidate ho opiso mu ercomenos hu uk emi ego axios hina lusot autu ton himanta to hypodematos Tauta en Bethania egenito peran tu Iordanu hopu en ho Ioannes baptizon. Okay, so this is basically the testimony of John the Baptist, and I don't know if you were picking up what's happening, if you're picking up anything, but just a lot of words here, but it's the testimony of John, and they're coming down and asking him who he is, and asking him if he's the Christ, and he says that no, he's not. That are you Elias? And he said no. And are you that prophet? And he says no. And tells us that they're asking in order to get some sort of an answer to bring back to the ones that sent them, and they've been sent by the Pharisees and so forth. And he finally answers that he's the voice of one crying in the wilderness. And then it explains that they've been sent by the Pharisees, and then they ask him, why are you baptizing if you're not the prophet, if you're not Elijah, and if you're not the Christ? And then he goes, and of course, you know, he says, I baptize with water, but this one coming after me is mightier than I, and the laces of his sandals I'm not worthy to unloose. And then the last statement is that these things happen in Bethany near the Jordan, where John is baptizing. John, do you have a question there or anything?
Well, regarding that. Text itself. They have in several places, pros otu in verse 19 and ego in verse 27 in brackets, and it says they're dubious validity in the text, but they don't give any variance on it. Do you know why they do that? Is
Well, I'm not sure if they didn't bother to write it down, just because they don't make a whole lot of difference. Just to, you know, whether it's just simply a matter of emphasis. You might check Nestle. Some of the others are going to see that some things more important than others, and give you the full apparatus on it.
Nestle has full apparatus.
Yeah, probably. You might check them on both of these.
Commentary might.
You might even check the UBS commentary on this, and sometimes they say things that they don't have down here, and they may just give you the general philosophy as to what they're doing whenever they put things in brackets. Okay, let's go back to verse 19, and we'll go through this. I'll go through more slowly and see if you can follow along. Okay, verse 19. Kai haute estin he marturia tu Ioannu hote apestelon pros auton hoi iudaioi ex Hierosolumon hieres kai levitas hina erotesosin, let's do that again, erotesosin auton su tis a kai homologesin kai uk ernesato kai homologesin hoti ego uk emi ho Christos kai erotesan auton ti un su elias a kai lege uk emi ho prophetes esu kai apocryphe u epon un auto tis a hina apocryphen domen tois pempsasin hemas ti leges perisa autu efe ego phone boontos en te eremo euthunate ten hodon kuriu kathos epen Esaias ho prophetes kai apestalmenoi eisan ek ton pharisaion kai erotesan auton kai epen auto ti un baptizes esu uk e ho Christos ude Elias ude ho prophetes apocryphe autois ho Ioannes legon Ego baptizo en hudati. Mesos hemon hesteken. Hon hemes uk oidate. Ho opiso mu erkomenos. Hu uk emi ego axios. Hina luso autu ton himanta tu hypodematos. Tauta en Bethania egenito peron tu Iordanu hopu ein ho Ioannes baptizon. Okay, go ahead and add that section if you haven't already to your daily reading. Yes.
I'm going to ask you about your emphasis. In verse 21, you go, kai ero, erotesan auton, and then you say, and then you pause there, and then
right.
You say, you
lay on A. Mm-hmm.
You've got a different
Y. Okay. All right, yeah, the reason here is there's a question and answer going on. See, the ti un su, now you see that...
ti un should be a question mark, and then su lay on A, question mark.
Oh, is that the way you've got it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, mine's different. Mine's got the... That could be confusing.
Semicolon.
Mine's got the semicolon after su.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah.
So your edition's probably different, so
yeah,
they just changed the punctuation. Okay, the first edition, mine's a third probably, so. Okay, so there's a difference. That would be confusing. All right. Well, it's just a matter of judgment here, the way they're going to put it. See, the T-1 is definitely a question. And... the way that my text has it is, who are you then? And then it's, are you Elias? Are you Elias? And the other is putting the su with the other. See, the trouble is, the su is just a personal pronoun, you. And but the verb form a on Elias a is also second person, so you have to translate that, who are you? And it just kind of depends on where they wanted to put the emphasis on the su. And in English, it's not going to translate. It's going to translate pretty much the same either way. There's just not too much we can do with it, because we have to have a U in both of those to make any sense. Let me put it this way. If you put the semicolon after ti-un and then say su Eliase, it's more like saying, what then? Are you Elias? And this way it's, who are you? Are you Elias? So it's not going to make a whole lot of difference, but it's a matter of judgment. The original text didn't have any punctuation. You can tell it's a question from the T, because that's introducing a question, but it's a matter of judgment. So that's going to be a little difficult when we're reading it out in class, because you're looking at two different things. So I'll just try to keep that in mind as I read through, and then you just, with the text that you've got, try to, on your own, just preserve the sense of it. There's going to be some slight variations of punctuation, apparently.
I have done that because in verse 22, it's the tis a there.
Mm-hmm.
It's the tis a semicolon, and then hina, apokrisin, they go on again. Maybe preserving parallels in between.
That's probably partly involved, but we do have some distance between them, so it's not going to be too critical either way. So I'm glad you pointed that out. It would be frustrating for you to think that I'm putting no emphasis, no pause, and so forth with this punctuation. Okay, how many of you have it the way it is in my book, with question mark after Sue? Okay, just a couple of you. Okay, just have an archaic version.
Huh?
Yes, well, yeah, there's down there, and the punctuation, they've got some variance there, so they probably just changed their mind. They had a D rating on this one anyway, so. Okay.
What edition is yours?
Let me take a look here. Second edition. Mine's second. Are yours third?
Yeah, third.
Okay. Maybe to solve this, I'll just have to get a third edition. It'd be awful lot harder for you guys to get second edition. Okay. Any other questions? Was that the only place where you saw any real deviation as far as punctuation? Okay. Go ahead, Daniel.
In verse 19, is it correct that
you
also Lumon
has a rough breathing? Yeah, it's a rough breathing, yes. Hierosolumon. Hierosolumon. I might have missed that. Yeah, it's a rough breathing. I'm always thinking, when I see this word, I'm always thinking of the Hebrew, so I'm trying to pronounce it in Hebrew, and so that's, yeah, Yerushalayim, and I start off that way and then realize I'm in Greek and try to change it over, you know. So, Hierosolumon, yes, thank you. Okay, any other questions? See, the problem in Greek, in trying to transliterate a word that began with a yod in Hebrew, they don't have a yod sound. So like Jesus and so forth too. You often do it with the iota epsilon or iota eta, something like that. And in this case, they went ahead and added a rough reading on it too. Okay. Good. Well, keep up on your reading. And second year, we'll do more than reading. We'll do the translating as well. But we've got a few more pieces of the puzzle to put together so we can do that. But you start to pick up a few things as you go. You start to see the case ending, start to recognize some of those things. We are in the midst of reviewing lessons 7 through 11, and we won't take any more time than this than necessary, but I do want you to ask any questions that you have problems with. And we went through chapter 8 yesterday as far as review, or just about through that. We were talking about the fact that there are five guidelines for determining in a predicate construction which is the predicate nominative and which is the subject. Like we talked about all of those, and you will need to be aware of those principles for the test. And then section 59 is a minor point here, and maybe a debatable point also. It says it should be particularly noticed that when a predicate nominative precedes the verb in Greek, it generally does not have the article. Since this is true, it is frequently necessary to supply a definite article in English, even though there is none in Greek. So I would just kind of put a little bit of grain of salt on that, because I'm not so sure. Here, even in this example, hutos ho anthropos huios that u ein, this man was the son of God. And then he goes on and says, or this man was a son of God. So it makes you wonder how hard and fast he's holding this rule. He's suggesting that the article isn't always needed in a case where the predicate nominative precedes the verb, as it does here. And I think we'll pursue the details of that later on when we discuss the article. I don't care that you worry too much about it right now. And I think it's somewhat debatable anyway. Okay, chapter 9 then, adjectives. As far as reviewing the adjectives is concerned, he starts out again like he has in most of these, defining the adjective in terms of really one of these syntactic definitions where it fills certain spots, certain positions in the language, and he defines those in terms of the English patterns. And then he introduces the concept of attributive versus predicate positions in English. And in attributive position, the adjective is just modifying the noun and is really basically being treated as one unit with the noun in the functioning in the sentence, whereas in the predicate position, there's an actual statement of the relationship, and the adjective is on the other side of the verb, usually a form of the verb to be, at least in English. And then section 61 talks about the fact that an adjective basically has the idea of the meaning of modifying, qualifying, limiting, identifying, or describing the meaning of the noun with which it's connected. So that's a general description of what an adjective does. None of that should be awful. Should be anything really great, really new. He mentions in section 62 the fact that in English adjectives can often be used as nouns, what we call a substantive function, and the same is also true in Greek. In fact, it's more frequently seen in Greek than it is in English. Far more frequently seen in Greek, and we'll even see it later when we get to a thing called a participle, which is a verbal adjective. It's an adjective that's got verbal idea. And those are very frequently used as nouns and take a substantive position. So we'll get used to this. It's very frequent in Greek. Now, as far as Greek is concerned, section 63 talks about the fact that Greek adjectives are inflected for case, number, and also for gender. Now, what rule would be involved here, a grammatical device would be involved in the fact that the adjective is going to agree with the noun, the case, number, and gender?
Concord,
right, concord or agreement. So the adjective is going to have concord with its noun in case, number, and also gender. So in all three of these categories. And we've already seen this somewhat with the article, because the article can be described as an adjective in a certain sense, a very particular type of adjective, but adjectives in general are inflected for case, number, and gender, which means then that each adjective is going to have quite a number of different possible forms. You're going to have different forms for all the cases, so you've got four forms on that basis. You've got to have different forms for the number, so you'll have singulars and plurals. That brings you up to eight forms, 2 times 4. And then you've got three genders, so that's going to bring you up to a potential of 24 different forms for any given adjective. And it's not actually 24 different because some of the ones have the same, like the neuters and the nominative and accusative and so forth. But nevertheless, 24 potential different forms for any given adjective because of that. Yes?
What about this, at the bottom it says they're also like for degree of comparison.
Mm-hmm. We'll deal with that later on, but that has to do, it's not really a different set of endings. There's kind of a stem change and then the endings change. So you can think of it as there's a certain inflectional type of system for degrees of comparison. Like in English, we have good, better, and best. The comparatives and the superlatives. Well, you'll have a similar situation in Greek, and we will deal with those in due time. There's nothing, that's not as bad as it sounds, because like I said, the ending systems are going to be the same. It's just a matter of there's something that changes before the ending, and we'll get to those. We're holding off on that because many of those get into third declension, so that's why we're waiting on those. Okay. Then, Greek adjectives we should take up in this lesson said to be the first and second declensions. So the adjective that we're dealing with now is an adjective of the first and second declensions. Because now, see, when you're dealing with an adjective, it's going to have endings for masculine, feminine, and neuter, and those endings are going to be in certain classes of declension. And so a given adjective in Greek, in this category, is going to be an adjective that's both first and second declension, because the masculine endings, masculine and neuters, are going to be second declension, the feminines are going to be first declension. In most cases, except for something like ionios. So the majority of your adjectives are declined like kalos, good, and you can just see the endings here. Your masculines, kalos, kalon, kaloi, kalus. Now realize all we had in this paradigm up to this point was nominatives and accusatives. So the full paradigm of this, you'd have kalos, what would be the genitive singular? Kalu, dative singular, kalo, omega with the other subscript, and then the accusative here, kalon. Plurals would be nominative kaloi, what would be the genitive plural? Kalon, omega nu, and dative plural, kalois, and then kalus, as you see here. Okay, so that's the fuller paradigm. And the feminine first declensions, same type of thing here, except that in the first declension feminines, just like with the nouns, you have to be concerned about whether the stem ends in a row or vowel, at which time you'll get alpha type endings, just like you do with the nouns. All right? And the neuters, pretty straightforward. Dictionary forms of the adjectives. You will have the dictionary form, it will be the nominative, singular, masculine form, and then there will be a comma with two endings after that. The first one will be the feminine, the second one will be the neuter. Now the only exception to that will be adjectives that will have no separate feminine endings, like ionios. Ionios will just have ionios comma on, and that's to indicate that the feminines and the masculines are the same. They have the same forms. Okay, and that's given down at the bottom of the page anyway. And section 66 just talks about this feature that if the stem ends in a row or a vowel, then you have alpha type endings. Fortunately, with the adjectives, you don't have these some other kinds category where they go some alphas and some etas. The adjectives are going to be all one or the other. Okay. Any questions on the forms of the adjectives? It's nothing really new there. It's just applying the same things you know about noun endings, except that any given adjective will have masculine, feminine, and neuter endings, whereas any given noun will only have one of those three. See, a noun's not going to change its gender, but an adjective will change its gender to adapt to the noun with which it is associated. So the adjective's going to have more forms available because it's going to be stuck onto different kinds of things. Okay, the syntax of the adjective. This is perhaps the most difficult part, at least at first. In Greek, we have first feature here is the concord or agreement that the adjective agrees with the noun in case, number, and gender, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it will rhyme or that the endings will be exactly the same. And for what reason? Reason or reasons, is that the case? Yes?
Adjectives end in a row or vowel.
Right. Yeah, if the adjective happens to end in a row or a vowel and it's stuck onto a noun that doesn't end in a row or a vowel, then you'll have alpha-type endings on the adjective and eta-type endings on the noun, so they won't rhyme. What other situations can occur where you won't have...
Converse.
Yeah, you can have the converse of that. And there's still others. Yeah, Glenn?
Well, if you have like a masculine first declension, then you have your adjective takes the second declension.
Right. If you had a masculine first declension noun, say mate tase, and you have an adjective applied to that, it would be, what if I want to say in the nominative singular, the good disciple? How was that? What's that going to sound like in Greek?
O
kalos mathetes, right. And there, os and ace don't rhyme. See, so they're not going to rhyme necessarily. They're not going to be the same ending. But you see, the first declension masculines are going to have endings that are somewhat similar to the feminine. You know, we naturally associate them with the feminine because that's the most predominant gender in that class. And so, but the adjective is always going to take second declension endings for the masculine forms. And the same thing will happen if you've got, say, a second declension feminine noun. If you wanted to say the good way, it would be what? Yes, hey kale hodos. Hey kale hodos. So there again, they don't rhyme. So the basic problem is, first of all, as Rick mentioned, in the first declension nouns, some are alpha types, some are eta types, and they may not necessarily rhyme. And then when you're dealing with first declension masculine, second declension feminines, the same thing can happen. And then later on, we'll see that if we have a third declension noun, for example, and we have a second declension, one of these regular types of adjectives stuck onto that, those endings aren't going to rhyme. Because the third declension endings are quite a bit different than these endings we've seen here. So you won't see a rhyme there either. So it's just to remind you that when you're reading through the text and you see things with an adjective modifying a noun and they don't seem to rhyme, don't be too concerned about it just because you're dealing with different declensions for each of those. Sometimes we'll get a third declension adjective. We haven't got to those yet. But a third declension adjective stuck onto, say, a second declension noun. And again, you won't see a rhyme between those. Okay. By the time you get done with all those exceptions, it's probably more often than not they won't rhyme than they do. All right? I don't know if that really works out or not, but it'd be interesting to take a poll through the New Testament and find out. Okay, the position of adjectives. This is very important because Greek doesn't really depend on word order that much, but when it comes to the adjective and the position of the adjective, word order is very important. That's the grammatical device that's making the differences to the meaning of something, and in this case, the meaning is quite radically different. I mean, it's significantly different anyway. To have a predicate position versus an attributive position is quite a significant difference. So in the position of adjectives, when the adjective modifies a noun which has no article, an anarthrous noun, then it can occur either before or after. And there's no problem. There's no real restraints on the position of the adjective when the noun is anarthrous. No article on the noun. The adjective can come before or after and have attributive meaning. But then, of course, there's an ambiguity because it could also be predicate meaning, too. And context will have to decide that. It's usually not as difficult as it sounds, though, because suppose you saw something like pistos diakonos, a faithful minister. If you saw that, that's the only thing you saw, and that was the whole sentence, pistos diakonos, you'd have to translate it, a minister is faithful, because there's no other verb, there's nothing else in it, you know. So, but if you see it, pistos diakonos, and then another verb form and another direct object or something, then you know it's attributed, because you've got another verb in the sentence. So it's not as difficult as it sounds. It's not as ambiguous as it sounds. And I don't know if you'll very often, if ever, see in the New Testament an anarthrous construction that's predicate anyway. It's not a very common type of thing to want to be saying. Okay. Yes, what? What's that? Either immediately before or after, right. Yeah, if it's this type of construction. Now, you might have some other adjectives associated, too. But so So when you get more than one adjective associated, then there's a competition for the position, you know. Sometimes you'll see one in front and one in behind. And when these anarthrous constructions, though, I don't know if you'll ever see a lot of adjectives or a lot of anything stuck into them. Yes?
Well, it's the convention and the norm of the adjective, if it's anarthrous, will follow the anarthrous noun.
Not really, because here you see them both ways. Pistos, diakonos, mikra, zume. There, you see them both places there. It's ahead of it, and then the last two examples, it's behind the noun.
Well, no, I meant if it's...
If it's predicate, you mean?
Anarthrous.
Yeah, these are anarthrous cases. These are anarthrous nouns.
Where are you at?
I'm on page 52, position of adjectives, number 2 there.
Oh, I see.
Now, if it's an anarthrous noun, the adjective can occur before or after. And whether it's before or after, I think, is going to be largely determined by the style of the writer and the emphasis that he wants to put on.
So it'll be clear. I mean, could you run into a situation where you have a predicate construction already, like, he is a faithful minister,
mm-hmm.
and set up with he and the predicate, that would be a predicate noun to fill with it.
Yes, you would have a regular pronoun form for he, and that's
right.
going to be considered pretty much definite anyway. You know, anytime you use a pronoun, it's definite. So even though it doesn't have the article, you got a pretty definite construction there, and you wouldn't have any difficulty knowing what's happening there. But you might see the adjective before, or following, even a word like he. Yeah, you might see it before or after. In other words, in English, it's almost like saying a faithful minister is he, versus he is a faithful minister. You could see it either way. Okay. That's kind of a peculiar example. I mean, we'll treat the pronouns as a separate category just because of, you know, questions that could arise as to how the adjective positions are going to fit into that scheme. All right. In all these examples, the adjective is said to be attributive and has the meaning of modifying the noun exactly as the corresponding English constructions. When an adjective modifies a noun which has a definite article, it may have any one of four positions. It may come between the article and the noun, and so these four positions we've already discussed, and I don't know if we want to spend too much more time with it here, but just by way of review, in attributive position, now with articular nouns, in attributive position, the adjective will follow the article and come before the noun in the first attributive position. In the second attributive position, there'll be a repetition of the article following the noun and then the adjective. And then the predicate positions, the adjective will come before the noun and its article out in front, or following the noun and its article with no repetition of the article. So that makes the difference. Okay, questions? Yes, Dan.
Article,
doesn't really matter. They don't even use the position designations because you need the article to define those positions. So there's really no label for the position here. This would just be considered an attributive adjective.
And that
could
go by context, but
mm-hmm.
Yes,
it's probably not likely to be a predicate situation just because I don't know if he mentions anything here or not. I guess nothing. You would be more likely to see the verb to be actually expressed in a case where you're dealing with a general maxim like that, a such and such is such and such. You'd probably be more likely to see the verb to be actually expressed in a case like that. So I don't know if you actually even have to really face the issue, because it may just not even be done. I don't think there's any problem with it being a predicate position, but there's an ambiguity. But usually ambiguity is resolved by the context so easily that you hardly ever notice it's a problem. It's more often, almost all the time, you're dealing with an adjective that's articular when you're putting a modifier on it. And, in other words, the reason is that when you're modifying something, when you're putting an adjective on something, you've got something that's pretty much definite in mind in order to describe it. If you're describing something, you've got a pretty definite concept of it. So it's unusual to be describing general things, at least a lot more unusual. Okay, so don't use the terms predicate or attributive position and associated with anarthrous nouns. The terminology isn't used because the rules aren't to be applied that way. Because you see, either before or after isn't going to determine whether it's predicate or attributive. That's only going to be determined by context anyway. So most often it's attributive. So that's just the way he's categorized it. All right. Any questions about those four positions of with the articular noun? You will need to memorize those four positions. Be very familiar with them because we're going to be hitting this over and over again. Not only with adjectives, we've already seen with genitive phrases. And what was the peculiarity with the genitive phrases that's different than this? Anybody remember? Genitive phrases occurring in these four positions.
They are all genitive phrases. They're never predicate.
Right, it's never predicate construction. It'll occur in any of those four positions, but the meaning is always attributive. In other words, the genitive phrase is always modifying the noun, and you never get a verb to be translated in there. You would do that with a completely different structure if you wanted to do it. Okay. That's a little ahead of the game here, but just to remember how these things parallel. Now, we're going to be talking about, there's certain types of adjectives whose meaning actually changes depending on whether it's in a predicate or an attributive position. And we'll get to autos a little bit later on. Some of those are very interesting. So you need to remember this distinction and get used to labeling these positions so that you can see what's happening in other cases later on as well. Okay. Then section 70 there is dealing with Greek sentences with a structure noun, nominative verb, and adjective, subject, verb, adjective, variable word order, or V is an equative verb. And you can see that occur as well. You will have instances where the verb is actually stated. And especially when it's, when you want to say became, if you want to use ginomai, which is an equative verb, but it's got a slightly different connotation than to be, you're not going to be able to really get the idea of something becoming something by using a predicate structure because there's no verb form there, and so you're always associating it with a verb to be. So if you want to say something where something became something, you'll use the actual verb form and then set up the structure. Again, still having your adjective in the nominative case or whatever case the noun was in, but now with a clearly stated verb to be. And then in some cases, the verb to be will actually be stated also, not even when it's not ginomai. For example, it's Matthew 14:24. Ein enantios ho animos, the wind was contrary. Well, there we have the verb ein there, the verb to be being expressed. Of course, here in this case, you're dealing with a past tense situation too. And that may be part of the reason. If the context was dealing with a present narrative or a past narrative, they'll often, you know, use the verb to be because it's a little bit more clear in the context. I should say, though, that a predicate construction can occur in a context in which the tense idea is past. In those cases, you may want to translate the construction by a verb, an English verb form of the verb to be in the past, because the whole context is past. In other words, the book was heavy or something like that at the time that they're writing. So in their context, the book is heavy, but now we're looking at the whole thing. We're translating with a past tense verb form. We won't worry about that for now. For now, in the exercises and tests and that kind of thing, just translate it with the present tense of the verb form. Later on, when we get into more detailed context and so forth, you'll see that you may change that to past or future, depending on the context. Okay? But if there's any doubt or ambiguity about the situation, they can go ahead and put the verb to be in there and solve the whole problem and resolve any kind of ambiguities that there might be there. All right? So, and then when you do that, when you put the verb form in there, then you relax your requirements as far as the position of the adjective in these predicate positions. So now the word order is variable again, and you don't have to worry about it because the verb to be is actually stated. So when the verb to be is stated, or to become or whatever, then your word order requirement is no longer needed. So you can see this first example, tahimati agenito lo ka. Now the adjective is following the verb, but in the next example, the verb's first, then the adjective, then the subject. And in the last example, the adjective is first, and the verb, and the subject. So the word order is going to vary. But that's only in the case where you have the verb to be stated. When you are using a predicate construction, then you've got only two options for a predicate construction. Either it's going to have to come before the article is noun or after the article is noun. Yes, Glenn?
Can you ever put the adjective and subject in there in a attributive predicate idea, like te, po, enantios, animos, that kind of thing.
Well, if you do, and then you put a verb form in, there'll be something else that you're equating it with. In other words, you wouldn't have that position. You wouldn't say, hey...
You make an attributive into a predicate by adding a verb. You're always just making an incomplete sentence.
Yes, that's right. What you do is be making an incomplete sentence, that you're asking for something else. Because once you put an attributive position, then it's modifying that noun. Now that verb is going to be equating that unit with something else. And if you don't have something else there, then you've got just a kind of a dangling sentence. You know, the person is waiting for you to finish your utterance. Yeah, that's what you say. The contrary wind was something. See, so you would no longer be saying the wind was contrary. And once you put it in attributive position, then that adjective is modifying that noun, and the verb is now equating that with something else. Okay? So you could say something like, the contrary wind was furious, or something like this, and then have another predicate adjective in that other position. Okay? But you can see that attributive position kind of locks that adjective right in. If you think of it that way, it's kind of when you stick something between an article and its noun, it's going to be very intimate with the noun. You know, nobody splits up an article and its noun unless they mean business. You see, in other words, it's going to be one. You see, there's going to be one unit now, and then of course in the second position where the article is repeated, that also serves to function the same thing, because in effect it's saying that this. The article is being repeated, and it's tying this thing, locking it right into that other unit. So after a while, you get the feeling that that's exactly what's happening. This thing is being considered a unit now. If it's coming between the article and the noun, or if it's the article is repeated, it's being made a unit with the thing, and now the whole thing functions together in the sentence. Okay? Section 71... Greek adjectives also occur in syntactic positions ordinarily occupied by nouns. This is that substantive use of the adjective, and this is rather frequent in Greek, so it's something we need to pay attention to. An adjective will be just put in the position of a noun and function like a noun, sometimes even with other adjectives associated with it and modifying it. But here's a couple of examples. The last shall be first. That's pretty frequent. Excuse me. Eson taiho eskatoi protoi. Eskatoi and protoi both. Well, protoi could be considered a predicate adjective here, but eskatoi is definitely being considered in a function of a noun. And what is it that tips you off to that in the context? What's telling you that eskatoi, which is normally an adjective, is functioning like a noun here? Yeah, the article. See, hoi eskatoi. And there's nothing else there. You see, it's not hoi eskatoi something. It's just hoi eskatoi. Period. And that's what's functioning in that position. So you know that that's being the last or the last one, something like that, you see. So your article is going to be one of the chief determiners of that. It won't always be. It happens to be an arthrous, like you see in this next example, tu floi and choloi and leproi and so forth. Then the thing that tips you off is the fact that there's no other subject there for the verb. And there's no other candidates for it. That's the only word there, and then there's a verb following it, and so forth. So you know that that's going to have to be construed as functioning like a noun. Yes?
This almost looks like what I was just suggesting before, is that you've got that's an entire verb, and then you've got hoi eskatoi protoi. You could say hoi protoi is the noun, and eskatoi is modifying it, sort of an attributive position, then you've got an incomplete sentence.
Well, no, well, I see what you're saying, yeah. The last first, yeah. You could. I mean, the reason that you know that isn't the case is because that's all there is in the sentence, you know. In other words, you could have that, but then you'd have to accuse the New Testament writer of writing an incomplete sentence. and since we prefer not to do that, we assume that that he's right in making a complete sentence. But you're right there. It's possible to say something that the last first will be something else. The last first one will be something else. Yeah, that could be the case. You could consider protoi a noun, eskatoi an adjective modifying that, and then esontai to be an equative verb. But then, of course, you need something else. See, if there was another thing in the nominative case, say in the front of the verb or something, then that would be the information that would be transmitting that idea across, and you'd have to render it that way. So, yes, it's a possibility. I never thought of that one before. That's a good one. Okay. But context, again, is your guide. That's what tells you that can't be, just because there's nothing else in the sentence that's equated to.
So this situation really would apply in sort of using the adjectives to make them, not every adjective, could every adjective be made into a
They're pretty liberal with those, but it's hard to say. You have to look at the sense of the context and to see if it makes any sense in the context. And that combined with the rules that you know and the possibilities that exist will usually be enough information to tell the difference. Yeah, that's straining it, and you see, the thing that would tell you there, the last first ones, you'd have to have something else in the sentence, otherwise it'd be an incomplete sentence, so that wouldn't be a possibility in under those circumstances. That's pretty easy one to tell the difference in. There will be instances, though, and I might just mention this now, because we'll talk about it more in the second year, but this distinction between the substantive use of an adjective and a noun itself is sometimes fuzzier than it may appear. Sometimes it's hard to tell whether you're looking at a noun or an adjective in the substantive, because many times in the New Testament, for example, a given adjective may be used in the substantive so frequently that the thing is also listed as a noun. Because, it's functioning that way all the time, and so it's hard to know whether this is just a consistent use of this adjective in a substantive or whether it's a noun in its own right. And sometimes people get, there are situations where there's a question as to what's really going on. And sometimes you can see, treat things as two nouns in apposition, where another person might analyze it as an adjective modifying a noun. There's one case in John 1:18 we wrestle with. Homonogenes theos. Well, monogenes could be construed as an adjective modifying theos, in which you'd have the only unique or only begotten theos, God. Or it could be construed as a substantive use of an adjective functioning like a noun in apposition to another noun, in which case you translated the only unique one who is God. And so it gets to be a kind of a sticky issue sometimes. And you can find places where the thing is used both ways, independent of that, and that makes it even more difficult. So I don't know if I should have cast doubt on your confidence here yet or not, but there are some situations in which it gets a little sticky as to whether you're dealing with a substantive use of an adjective or whether the thing is to be considered as a noun in its own right. Or in some cases, there's even a question as to whether it's an attributive use of an adjective or two substantive or an adjective that's being substantively used in apposition to another noun. Most of the time, that's not a problem, but it's only in a case like John 1:18 where it's a very difficult passage and the whole wording in the context is very unusual. Then you've got to start looking at some of these other possibilities and you need to know what possibilities exist. If you don't know what possibilities exist, then you can be in lots of trouble, too. And then you're kind of at the mercy of the commentators. Yes?
When you have two or three possibilities like that, mm-hmm. is there another set of rules or considerations that would give preference for one over the other? Where you'd be able to say, most probably, least probably.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think so. I think in a case like the one I just described, there are factors involving just basic meaning, factors involving does it make the scripture contradict itself, does it contradict another statement in the scripture, and so forth. Things that you deal with in hermeneutics will often be the things that you will have to use to decide. And that's a good point. I'm glad you brought it up. Your understanding of Greek grammar is going to help you tremendously, but there will be still cases in which, even knowing all the Greek grammar, you're going to have to follow the basic principles of hermeneutics. You can't make it contradict another scripture. Just like in English, statements can sometimes be ambiguous, so they can be in Greek. And so you're going to have to look at the rest of the tenor of scripture. And I think in that one case of monogenes theos, to have monogenes as an adjective modifying theos and have God begotten is going to be contradictory to all kinds of other scripture. So there's a reason, a compelling reason to say, no, it's got to be this other possibility, see? So there's things like that that need to be brought into the picture. Yeah. There's another question of textual criticism. This is assuming that this is the proper reading. Now, how are we going to interpret it? Okay. And then there's other factors in that one, too. That issue is more complex because monogenes doesn't necessarily mean begotten. It's been translated that way, but it doesn't really contain that implication at all. It's has more the idea of uniqueness and so forth. And just because Trinitarians have generated this idea of the only begotten Son, and everybody says that phrase so frequently, the Greek doesn't really justify that translation. I won't get into any more than that now. We'll save things, little tidbits like that for the second year when we get into... We'll take a few things like that then just to use as illustrations for what we're trying to get at. Okay. few more minutes left here as far as review is concerned. Any questions on any of this? I guess Section 72 I didn't mention anything about, but there's a case in which just the opposite takes place. Sometimes a noun may be used like an adjective, and that's where you get apposition, two things in apposition to each other. And that, of course, again, can generate some confusion in some cases. But functionally, there's really a clear similarity between the two. And when two nouns are in apposition, meaning they're juxtaposed, they're right next to each other. And in meaning-wise, an appositional construction is one in which two nouns are put together, one of them, and both of them referring to the same thing. It's almost like a streamlined Granville Sharp situation where both of these, see, Jesus and Ho Christos, Jesus Ho Christos, Jesus the Christ, Jesus the Messiah, see, that's both Jesus and Messiah, Christ here, refer to the same person, the same thing, and both terms are describing that one entity, and John the Baptist, the same thing, John the Baptist, both nouns are describing the same thing, so they're functioning together as one unit. And the second noun could be taken as a modifier of the first noun to give more information about it, in which case it's functioning very much like an adjective would, except that it's technically a noun. And so, baptistes, for example, you'll never see an adjective with an eta sigma ending like that unless we get into third declension types. And so that's going to have to be considered a noun, technically. It doesn't have the endings like adjectives. Yet, it's functioning like an adjective. Okay. Those uses are pretty obvious when you see them, though, and most students don't have too much of a question when they see a construction like that. Genitive case, then, is the next chapter, genitive and dative case, chapters 10 and 11. And this is just a matter of filling out the paradigms and also recognizing how these are used. Remember, we had a kind of an inductive study here where you looked, inspected these forms, and then did your exercises and begin to see what forms fit into what categories, notice some things about them. So nothing too much to say about the forms. That's just a matter of memorizing the paradigm. And so we'll have a genitive form as well as the nominative and accusative we had before. And the genitive, as far as meaning is concerned, we're keeping it relatively simple to start with. But it's a good working framework anyway. Even when we get to the complexities later on, we'll find that the general ways of translating the genitive that are given here are the ones that you're going to be using. You may have some more understanding of exactly how the functions are and what options exist in certain situations, but that's more of a refinement. You can get by pretty well just with the understanding of this. Just by translating, whenever you see a genitive, just by translating it of something, that's a pretty good rule of thumb for finding out, you know, getting a good translation to start from. And you'll seldom go wrong if you just translate the genitive always as of something. Use the English preposition of. Because your possessives will come out okay there. The word of the Lord, the Lord's word, you see. And your most of your other functions will come out the same. As it turns out, the prepositional phrase of something is a pretty good translation in English, because the range of meanings of the prepositional phrase of and the range of meanings of the genitive in Greek correspond pretty well. So it is kind of interesting in this case that there's a pretty direct parallel between the two. Major difference being that Greek is doing it with a case ending, whereas English is using a prepositional phrase. And Greek has a further capability then, because they've got the case ending to indicate a lot of things. When they add prepositions to the case endings, they get more refinement than we can get. So they can add things like ek and so forth to the prepositional phrase, to the case endings, and they can get a lot of refinement. That's why Greek tends to be so precise with regard to prepositional usage, because they've got prepositions and case endings both that they can mix in various forms and fashions to get more precise shades of difference. And that's not always perceived accurately by people who are looking at Greek, so they can... this is where you get textbooks or lexicons and others giving you various meanings. Somebody looks up the meaning they like, you know, because there's such a range. But the range is not a range that occurs in every case. It's you need to know what the range is, but you need to also know what the specific context and the rules in the context demand, and then that will determine which of those meanings fits in that case. Well, we'll talk about genitive case and review next Tuesday, and As I said, now's the time. I want to take the time to take any questions that you have, make sure that we understand this before we face the test on it. It's not a difficult test. No more difficult than the last one. I don't know if that's good news or bad news.
Could you say